Intro to Digital Archaeology.
Intro to Digital Archaeology.
Intro to Digital Archaeology.
HIST 3000.
At Carleton University.
With Professor Sean Graham.
Hi everyone, welcome to this introduction to Digital Archaeology. I'm Sean Graham, I'm in the History Department, but I am by training an archaeologist, a Roman archaeologist as it happens. But over the years, I've become more and more digitally focused, more and more digitally interested in working with legacy data and working with all of this amazing archaeological material that is collected and made online. This class is about working with all of that material and about teaching you to see this material with archaeological eyes. Now, speaking of eyes, I don't know about you, but I can't stomach any more Zoom meetings. There's something horrible about having to stare off-center at your camera so that it appears like you're looking out of your little window box at everyone else. And if I'm lucky, everyone else will be staring off-camera too, but more often than not, it's just me in a wall of blank squares, which is kind of depressing. And it all feels like horrible small talk at an awkward faculty social event. So we're not doing that, all right? Instead, I'd like you to listen to these short podcast episodes, for lack of a better word, each week, wherever it's comfortable for you to do that. And I don't see these as lectures, by the way. A good lecturer takes their cues from the audience reaction and interests, and obviously we can't do that here. So instead, these little episodes are going to follow the same basic structure, and they will serve as a bit of an introduction to the week. I will remind you of what you ought to be doing, I'll suggest things to keep in mind, and maybe I'll riff a bit on some of the key ideas for the week and how they link to previous weeks or how they foreshadow the upcoming work. I've also persuaded a number of digital archaeologists to join me throughout the course to offer up their thoughts on what it means to do digital archaeology. These interviews were recorded a few years back when I first did this course, but the theme of them is always relevant. How do you handle the challenges of digital work? Well, that's an evergreen topic. So this week is the Getting Started week, and I need to take a little bit more time than I would normally to lay some of the groundwork for how this course is going to unfold, for the key things that I want you to have in mind as we go forward. I've taught online for a variety of institutions using a variety of formats and approaches over the years. I've been doing this since at least about 2005. I like teaching asynchronously because I believe it's a kinder approach to complex topics. Chances are you like taking asynchronous learning courses because 9 times out of 10, an asynchronous course allows you to fit the work around the rest of your life. Well, those two ideas are complementary as long as we approach things in good faith, right? I don't think that rigor is demonstrated by forcing you to join me at set times, and I don't believe that face-to-face work is somehow more scholarly, more holy than other kinds of work. But I do think you have to feel confident that I'm not going to hit you with some kind of gotcha. You have to trust me when I say that learning is about process, about exercise, and I have to win that trust. So, you know, when I say that learning is a process, I'm not interested in that final written product, right? The goal is not to have a paper produced at the end of everything. If you go to a gym and there was a machine that moved weights from point A to point B, and you turned it on so that the weights were moved several hundred times, could you say that you had exercised? Well, isn't the point of a gym to have weights moved from point A to point B? No, that's ridiculous. The point of a gym is the process and discipline that comes from having lifted the weights for yourself. And each week, you challenge yourself by being able to lift a little bit more. The point of a class is not having written a paper or the grade at the end. I cannot emphasize this enough. The point of all of this is the process of pushing yourself to lift a little bit more each week. When I go to the gym, lifting 10 pounds 50 times in a row is the process that makes a difference for me. The big muscle-bound guy who lifts 300 pounds? Well, that's his process. And maybe that's easy for him. But right now, given the way my back is, 10 pounds is hard for me. Process is going to look different for everyone. We will have occasion to explore what AI and large language models offer archaeology, and I will tell you when we get there. But if you were to use ChatGPT to write something for me otherwise, what's the friggin' point? That's like having a machine at the gym that lifts the weights for you. I promise you, if you document your process in good faith and tell me what works and what hasn't, you will have met my goals for you. I will meet you where you are so that the you who leaves this class is different than the you who started it. I want to build a structure that opens possibility space for you to engage with digital archaeology. I find digital archaeology fascinating. I made my life around it. Why talk to a crappy chatbot when you've got an actual human who is invested in your success? So for all of this to work well, it requires you to be on the same page as me. And there's a lot of flexibility built into this course. But it does require you to try and push yourself out of your comfort zone. It requires you to lift a little bit more weight each week. Some weeks we work on legs, other weeks we work on arms. Sometimes we take a little bit of a break. And maybe I've pushed that metaphor far too far. But, you know, the key thing is always tie what you're doing with what you're reading and what you're thinking. And document that. And that can be hard, but it comes with practice. And when you start doing that, you start seeing the intersections with everything else. And that's where the learning happens. So that's why it is really important for you to document everything you do in this course. That is the process. Those are the things that you will show to me. And I will give you ungraded feedback. There are no grades attached to the weekly work. So I want you to just try. Swing for the bleachers. Your process is the learning. That's why this course is structured the way it is, and that's why it might look a little unfamiliar. So explore the complete website for the course, pay attention to the FAQ section, and decide whether or not this focus on process is for you. It might not be. And if that's the case, no harm, no foul. But it's better that you should make that decision now and start this course with your eyes open. And, you know, we start with an interesting exercise, I feel. I'm getting you to do some self-directed field work. I want you, if you're able, to go out to a local historic graveyard and do some data recording. And there is an alternative if that isn't feasible for you. And as a class, we will end up generating quite a lot of data that we will then be able to explore from various viewpoints and other digital archaeological approaches. I suppose it might seem a bit macabre, you know, or off somehow to build some of our work around the ways the dead are memorialized in Canadian graveyards. I settled on doing this for a variety of reasons. One, the simple reason that getting you outside and doing this one variety of archaeological work and thinking through how tech intersects with fieldwork and the realities of space is in itself a valuable exercise. And two, it does give us data that we can work on later as the weather grows worse. And, you know, we don't often talk about death in modern Western culture. Mortuary archaeology, burial archaeology, memorialization and its practices tells us a lot about past human groups. But in the gaps with our present, they can also teach us much about ourselves. And, you know, things are going to break, and some things will work better, be more effective than other things. It might be that my instructions take some prior knowledge for granted that isn't warranted. You can tell me. That's part of the process. Learning is full of rough edges. Things aren't always going to run smoothly. But if you can be patient with that, and I can be patient with you, if we can roll with it, it'll be awesome. Now, at this point, go get yourself a coffee, get yourself comfortable, because I want to talk to you about failure in technology and what rolling with it can really mean. And I'm going to tell you about some of the ways I've really screwed up in the past as I have become a digital archaeology. In fact, a lot of what I'm about to tell you comes from chapter one of a book I wrote called Failing Gloriously, where I put it all out there.
So sit back, make yourself comfortable, and we're going to talk about what failure really means. I want to start with Jon Snow in Game of Thrones. Jon Snow, he's not a tactical genius, really. He really isn't. But he is fortunate in that he has some good advisors handy, like Ser Davos, who says, "You go on, you fight for as long as you can, you clean up as much of the shit as you can." And Jon Snow says, "I don't know how to do that. I thought I did, but I failed." "Good. Now go fail again." And that's from season 6, episode 3. And I like this little exchange because what Ser Davos is arguing for is the productive fail. Unfortunately, Jon Snow rarely seems to learn the hard lessons. And if you don't learn from fail, if you don't learn from when things break and go wrong, well, then you really do know nothing, Jon Snow. I have no really good memory of where I first heard of the idea of the productive fail. At one point, I was a classicist. I wasn't a particularly good one, but I was. And the idea can be found in the writers of Greco-Roman antiquity. And you know, for as long as we've been human, there's always been somebody saying, "Walk it off." It's rather like what Chumbawamba once sang, "I get knocked down, but I get up again. You're never going to keep me down." It's not a new idea. It's not a profoundly deep idea, but it is a political idea, and it is a dangerous idea. It's dangerous in that without a strategy for dealing with the things that break, a strategy for failing productively, a fail is indeed a disaster and causes harm. You know, the modern university puts all of the risks of innovative teaching on the instructor with few supports in place. "Move fast and break things" was Facebook's early mantra, and that has caused untold damage to civil society. So this is political in that who gets to fail and suffer the consequences or not is a function of identity and power. I'm a white, middle-aged guy on the internet. When I first started blogging about my research in 2006, I didn't realize the degree to which I was protected by that identity, by the privilege that I had. Work by scholars like Catherine Cook makes it clear, and she writes, "Digital technologies, especially the web, were sold to us as democratizing tools that would transform the inequities inherent in communications, research, and institutional structures. When the shortcomings started to become visible, risk and danger were marketed to us as part of what everyone goes through to create good research and art, to innovate, to be successful. But that was not true either. Some people are forced to take on more risk than others. The lines of privilege and power are far more insidious in our technology-drenched worlds than those who benefit from it care to recognize, let alone address." So having a strategy to deal with things that break or do not work or go wrong is not the same thing as valorizing risk or promoting failure for failure's sake. But I'm not saying that I have the answer. But I think I can at least gesture towards an approach that begins to move the needle. To fail productively, you have to be aware of the multiple contexts of that fail to find the valuable experience. To fail gloriously is to use the privilege that you have as you are able to make it safe for others to fail. If you're not building other people up, why are you even here? A glorious fail is first and foremost an act of generosity. I recognize in this idea that I am allied with what Kathleen Fitzpatrick has called generous thinking, that is to say, a mode of engagement that emphasizes listening over speaking, community over individualism, collaboration over competition, and lingering with the ideas that are in front of us rather than continually pressing forward to where we want to go. But competition is everything in academia, and so academia is not set up to recognize productive failure. Indeed, in a competitive system, failure necessarily has to be punished. The systems and meshworks, the entangled flows of power and money and incentives that make up academia are fragile, and failure is seen as a rupture, a breaking, a threat. The ideology of fast fail that comes to us from the technosphere imagines a situation dealing with complex systems that can be perturbed to new, more productive and efficient configurations, as if this is a moral or ethical goal. In academia, this has the effect of corrupting research. Everything is always presented as a win. You know, I went looking for fail in the archaeological literature. My background's in archaeology, trained as an archaeologist. And so I built a topic model with 100 topics of nearly 20,000 archaeological articles from across the English-speaking world from the 1930s onwards. And do you know, I would have thought there'd be something in all of that where we talk about research that doesn't confirm a hypothesis, or research that just tries to replicate what somebody else found. I would have thought there'd be something like that, given the processual turn in archaeology, new archaeology, scientific archaeology more general. If this macroscopic perspective on the historiography of English-speaking archaeology is any indication, well, the answer is no. The incentives of professional practice mean that we don't want to hear about things that didn't work. We spin our words, we carefully prune to present work in the best light. To fail productively would mean an honest assessment of what happened. To fail gloriously would be to change the system so that honesty would not be seen as a radical act. If we knew where the dead ends were, the things that didn't work, if we were not hiding our fear of being found out, would we not produce better research, better teaching, healthier relationships, a stronger academy? My name is Sean Graham, and I am an imposter in this world. I have screwed up so many times. So many times have I tried to put the best possible gloss on things only to see the work immediately vanish in obscurity. You know, it doesn't feel like I didn't begin to gain any kind of traction until I started giving it all away, the things that worked, the things that didn't, on my research blog. And when I became an official academic again after 8 years of underemployment, it was against that context of trying to be open about what I was doing versus the show no weakness ethos of academia. And it didn't help that I was also in a history department with its own traditions and disciplinary expectations of what history was supposed to be. Even though the job ad said digital humanities, digital history, and even though everyone I spoke to expect me to define for them what digital humanities and digital history could be, my imposter syndrome was in high gear. I was the expert. God help us all. So let's take a whistle-stop tour of some of my fails, at which point we're going to try and retrieve something of value from them. Fail number one. As a graduate student, I worked on the Tiber Valley project at the British School at Rome. Part of this involved entering data from paper recording sheets into a custom-made Microsoft Access database. After several months of doing this, I still had a stack of sheets that I could not enter into the database because they had a particular where that was not in the little drop-down menus on the pottery forms. I had myself a little dig inside the database, figured out how I could add the where to the options. Presto! Backlog cleared. Of course, not really understanding the implications of what I'd done, I'd managed to break so much of the underlying dependencies and reports that I set that aspect of the project back months, starting from the moment I fixed things to the moment my fix was discovered. Fail number two. As a new member of the history department, I was interested in how Wikipedia generated knowledge, and so I assigned my students a task. Let's collaboratively update a Wikipedia page on the history of our region and see what happens next. The idea was to give the students first-hand experience of the collaborative knowledge building and peer review. I also wanted the students to engage with ideas concerning whose voice got heard on Wikipedia. These were first-year students who had arrived at university with very clear ideas of what proper historians did, and Wikipedia, after years of injunctions against it, was not proper history. I had built up to the day with a series of scaffolded exercises that I thought would mitigate this, but I was wrong. All of my actual history majors were sick that day, despite my scaffolding, and did not participate. Another example, fail number three. I don't suppose you remember the game company Infocom, if you're of a certain age. They had a magazine advertisement that sticks with me. It showed a brain with its parts lit up in different colors. The headline was something like, "The most powerful graphics engine in the world." By the early 90s, Infocom was fighting a rearguard action against the emergence of graphics-based games. But I remembered how immersive, how powerful those text-based games had been. And so I wrote one for my students in a class about the Roman city and countryside. We had been studying various maps and other top-down representations of that space. With the text-based game, that top-down representation couldn't be relied on. Instead, they would have to read and imagine the landscape from their character's position on the ground. The idea was to represent a Roman conception of space as a sequence of what comes next, as well as to give the students a taste of wayfinding in the Roman world through social interactions. Play a game versus read a paper. It should have been a no-brainer, I thought. And yet, the entire class balked, flat out refused to play. On a similar note, I remember the very first grad seminar I ever taught. Fail number four. I had never experienced a North American graduate program as a student. And by the time my students got to my course, most of them had already been well-disciplined in what to expect from graduate seminars in history. I framed the course as an experiment in digital history. How can we use augmented reality to tell good history? Well, this was in 2011, and the technologies involved were not in any sense easy. But I felt we had a good vibe going on in the class. Work was being produced, interesting work, powerful work. And yet, I received the worst teaching evaluation scores in the entire department, making for a rather inauspicious beginning for the untenured assistant professor. On those evaluations, which were filled at perhaps the lowest time of the year, most comments were a variation on, "If the tech doesn't work, will I fail?" and "How is this history?" and "I know how to write essays. I don't know what an A looks like here, so I don't know what to do." Other comments suggested the idea of experimenting was an unfair thing to do with students about to hit the job market. We all have fails like this lurking in our closet. The question is, how do we make these productive? How do we make these glorious? Well, the benefit of having a system for classifying our fails is that it can highlight elements in common between these disparate episodes. And once classified, we can figure out what to do about them. Once classified, we have a language for talking about them that removes the personal, "Oh no, I screwed up," and gives us a bit of critical distance. And this distance can also serve to give us a degree of protection. Brian Croxall and Quinn Warnick have an outstanding essay on failure and its role in teaching in digital pedagogy in the humanities, which I find enormously useful. For Croxall and Warnick, there are four kinds of fails. There's one, technological failure, two, human failure, three, failure as artifact, and four, failure as epistemology. The examples that I shared with you might be classified like this. The Tiber Valley Project database. Well, that's a human failure. That's a type 2 failure in that I did not know what I did not know. At the time, I thought I was dealing with a technological failure, but oops, I was a bit wrong about that. The Wikipedia assignment. Well, that's a type 2 failure. That's a human failure. The scaffolding focused on the wrong aspects of the work and did not address the powerful stories about what constitutes proper venues for work. Augmented reality for environmental history and interactive fiction? Well, that's type 1 and type 2, the tech and the human. The tech did not work as advertised, and the game of being a student was not confronted, disrupted sufficiently. That is to say, students are well trained in how to fulfill what Daniel Paul O'Donnell calls the compulsory figures of academia, essays and midterms. I did not make it safe for the students to do this new thing I wanted. Croxall and Warnick's taxonomy is something of a revelation for me. It crystallized things that I'd been blundering towards. Quinn Dombrowski has an even more complete taxonomy of fail, drawing on her experiences with, for instance, the digital research tools directory DIRT and Project Bamboo. Had I these taxonomies earlier when I was having those experiences in the first place, I might have retrieved something of value for my students and myself. So let's look at Kroxel and Warnick's typology a little bit more deeply. Their schema for classifying and understanding the types of fail we encounter also implies a strategy at the outset for dealing with the inevitable human or technological failures. Their type 3, failure as an artifact, means to accept that the fail is going to happen and to build into the course or research the examination of the fail itself as an object of study. Fail becomes a pedagogy, a way of being, when we hit type 4 and conceive of failure as epistemology, for it gives us license to actively seek out ways of breaking the technologies in the first place. We change our focus from product to process, and we craft teaching, learning, and research activities accordingly. As we engage with digital tech, whether for research or public history or history more generally, we need to teach students how to create, how to craft the compelling stories that the technology permits us to see. And nobody knows how to do this innately. It is not obvious, and it carries real risk. So in order to move to a glorious failure, we have to do one final thing. We have to share it. Failure as open reflection. It's this last step that we expand our productive engagement from the, from internally to the wider world, and we make what we do safe, and we make it safe for others without power or position, or who are precariously employed, or who are students, to fail as well. You know, my very first public fail as an official card-carrying academic, happened right at the start of my career. I was a new hire. The university gave me a small sum of money to start my research program. And trying to fit into what I thought of as the department's vision for my role as a contributor to the public history program, I came up with a project that would use the Ushahidi crisis crowdsourcing mapping platform to solicit and then map places of intangible cultural heritage. But because I really did not know what I was doing, I left the website that I built open to automated attacks. So there was this human failure, type 2, and what I didn't understand enough about the open source community to know to pay attention to the forum and the discussions, and especially the security discussions, and that left my code open to attack, the type 1. And when the site collapsed, it went offline. Its database was corrupted with Viagra advertisements that would be used to send out spam into the world. I wrote a postmortem about what had happened, and I posted it online. In my despair, my imposter status having been publicly confirmed, I inadvertently moved to a type 3 fail, where I discussed and studied what went wrong. That single blog post may have been the most important post that I ever made, for it led directly to the change in perspective that I needed in order to teach and learn this thing called digital history, this thing called the digital humanities, which is a type 4 fail. And sharing it online used the privilege that I had to develop a genre of discussing fails in a productive way. This certainly wasn't the first public discussion of a project that did not come together in a public way, but the experience became formative for everything that I've done since. I had never been trained to discuss or acknowledge the things that did not work. Framing what happened the way I did was liberating, for I realized the success or failure of that project was separate from my personal identity. Rather, it's epistemology, it is an artifact, and following Kroxel and Warnick, it is pedagogy. My job, I discovered, is to make it safe to try things out by emphasizing this framework for process rather than the product. But I want to consider one last thing from Catherine Cook, who writes, "When we risk going too far, we discover how far we can go. In today's era of motivational speak, risk has been singularly rebranded as a badge of honor. In turn, risk is considered a cornerstone of art, innovation, creativity, and ultimately change. Perhaps ironically, then, it is the Me Too, Idle No More, and Black Lives Matter movements, among others, that have shone a light on the dark underbelly of taking chances. The demand for individuals to step forward and share their voice paints targets on the already vulnerable and marginalized for fear and anger-filled hate and aggression, repeatedly and relentlessly beating down the voices of change. Often forced to choose between the long-term abstract risk of doing nothing, and therefore nothing ever changing for the better, and the immediate and often personal risks of trying to confront the system, the individuals leading the charge of these movements in the name of equity, security, and inclusivity face harassment, abuse, suspicion, imprisonment, and violence. Your personal security has to come first. One way I suggest for shifting some of the risks is to frame the work within this discussion of the kind of fail with which we're dealing. The second part is to move the discussion toward fail as something we study rather than something inherent in us, and then to a process, to a way we iterate through what we study. While Kroxall and Warnick's taxonomy functions as a tool toward better pedagogy, Dombrowski's taxonomy reminds us of the human costs and dangers because it is generated from the experience of the very real risks she underwent working on and shutting down projects, including the DIRT directory of digital research tools. She frames the different fails by their consequences, learning value, and sharing value. She sees, for people working in the digital humanities, that there are tech fails, career planning fails, communication fails, strategic fails, arbitrary job market fails, failures to probe assumptions, failures to acknowledge change, failures to forge a shared vision, failures to do right by others.
In terms of work this week, it's all about getting yourself set up with what amounts to your own digital archaeology laboratory. On the course website, each week has a page of instructions and then supporting tutorials or walkthroughs to help you do the tasks I want you to complete. In week one, you'll set up a GitHub account and make your first private repository. Don't forget to initialize that with a README. You'll see that option as you go through it. And don't forget to add me as a collaborator on your account. Each week, you'll make a new repository for that week's work, where all the bits and pieces that you create will be kept. You will also set up a Hypothesis account this week. Hypothesis is a web service that enables an overlay on anything you read on the web. And then you can make annotations at the level of individual words or paragraphs and so on. So it becomes a kind of collaborative reading environment. And we will have a group just for our class so that when I make annotations, you can see what I'm reading and paying attention to and thinking about. I can see what you are. And you can all interact and react to each other's annotations. In fact, have conversations in those annotations. So it's kind of a collaborative reading seminar. But make sure that you're always logged into our private group when you do that, because otherwise your annotations will be visible to the world. And finally, make sure to join our Discord server. I will do my office hours in there. It gives me a way of seeing your screen, or you can share your screen with me when things go wrong and we can troubleshoot. We can actually have voice chat one-on-one, or as small groups as necessary. It's a space for you, though. It's a space for you to socialize. It's a space for you to ask each other questions, ask for help, share what's going right, share what's going wrong. I don't look at those interactions in there as something to be graded. I see it more as kind of the chatter that happens in a classroom before the class actually starts, or afterwards, or in the hallway, or in the foyer of the department. So That's where our social space, where the social learning is going to happen. And it is really important that you're in there. It's okay to just lurk if that isn't really your scene, but it is where you will be able to find me and, you know, look for help and so on. And, you know, when things don't work or you get confused or it's not clear what I'm asking you to do, ask for help. It's not a sign of weakness. In fact, it's a sign of strength because digital archaeology is a team sport. You do not get extra points for being a heroic lone scholar, right? I don't want to read, oh, I wrestled with it for 3 hours and I just couldn't get it to work. If it doesn't work after 30 minutes, it's not going to come after 30 hours. So ask for help. You might get extra points if you're collaborative, helpful, and willing to ask for help when you need it. Okay? I really can't emphasize this enough. And if you get talking to somebody who's taken classes with me before, they will confirm that I actually mean this. Each week, I want you to record two documents. A notes document that's like a lab notebook. Into this goes the commands that you typed, error messages that you received, all those memos to self that help you remember how to do the digital tasks. The other document, let's call it a journal. It's where you do the joined up thinking, explicitly tying what you did, the successes and the hiccups, to the stuff that you've read, the issues that are raised by all of that. Each week, you log the location of these in a Google form so that I can take a look and help you out, okay? So you put those into your GitHub repository, you give me the link to that, and I go take a look. And at the end of each module, you use these to produce a consolidation document that will get submitted for grades. One last thing, you can't speed run this course. Don't try and do everything in the last 2-3 weeks of the course. If you don't meet the learning objectives, you can't get the grades. The learning objectives include being collaborative and reacting to my feedback and the feedback of each other in the course. So if you try and do everything at the last few moments of the course, it ain't going to work. And you're not going to get the grade you think you should be getting. Okay? Do not speed run. Try and do all of the work in the week that it is assigned. I understand that things are chaotic right now and that life is going to happen, and that's totally cool. If something comes up, you just have to let me know that something has come up. You don't have to give me the details. I don't need to see a doctor's note. Just let me know that something's going on. And we can roll with it. We can find some other way for you to be successful in this course. But I can't help you if you don't let me know that something is up. All right. So that's about enough out of me for now. Please read the syllabus pages carefully. Read the week one materials carefully. When things are unclear, ask me or your peers for clarification. Help each other out. Remember, digital archaeology is a team sport. And I'm really looking forward to working with you and coaching you this semester.